Cinema! Cinema!
You're listening to the Cinemaphile Podcast with Andrew Shearer, brought to you by OnlineAthens.com.
Hi, this is Andrew Shearer, movie columnist for OnlineAthens.com and the Athens Banner Herald. Thank you for listening to the Cinemaphile Podcast. I had a great conversation this morning with Mark Kendall, an Atlanta-based comedian who is also an ensemble member at Dad's Garage Theater. He is bringing his one-man show called The Magic Negro and Other Blackness to the Moonlight Theater on Pulaski Street this Thursday, October 10th, and Friday, October 11th. Mark and I talked about movies. He brought up Citizen Kane. We talked about Chris Rock is in here. Chappelle's show. All the ingredients that go into making a one-man show like this. And when I talk to people about movies, that's like a normal thing for me. That's an everyday thing for me. But in conversations about race in film, whenever I've brought up something like The Magic Negro or The Magic Asian, I'm surprised at how many film fans are still kind of like unfamiliar with that term and don't realize what it is that they're seeing when they see these movies. So Mark is a very, very smart person, loves movies. I could have a whole other podcast discussion with him just about film. MoonlightTheaterCompany.com is where you would buy tickets for The Magic Negro, and that's happening again this Thursday, October 10th, Friday, October 11th. Here now is my conversation with Mark Kendall.
I think the time when it went more than like a surface level that I like, you know, definitely remember, that was probably when I was around 16. I think that's when I first started writing and setting scripts and things like that. Around the time I was maybe 17 or 18, I got really into Spike Lee. And I don't know if you remember these, but he released these books, like these companion books that would go along with his movies.
I do.
And yeah, and so it was really cool because it was for these movies that came out like in the 80s and the 90s before DVD. I mean, I also had access to DVDs at the time, but when they were originally coming out, it was kind of like DVD commentary before DVD commentary. And even at the time, so this would have been like early mid 2000s when I was discovering these books, like 20 years after the movies had originally come out, it was really useful because it felt like he wasn't trying to hide any secrets. So it's like you read these books and he's very upfront about difficulties he had with like getting the project funded, dealing with the film studios that maybe didn't understand his vision. Making mistakes in pre-production and production and editing, like mistakes that he himself made as like a filmmaker. And so it was just really this kind of like unfiltered peek into what making movies was like. And he, I think, was very outspoken about trying to depict black people in a way that he thought was true to himself and things that he wanted to see. And so I think that was perhaps the first time that I started to analyze films beyond just like, oh, them being this piece of entertainment. And
yeah.
Also, in addition to that, just kind of like, you know, this is sort of like a statement from the filmmaker, the people that made this movie. So that was when it started, I would say. It's like high school.
I remember the Driving Miss Daisy winning over Do the Right Thing. Everybody was like, the Oscars So White thing happened like years and years later, but that was one of the first times that I think I can remember for that being
right.
Like a a good example of that happening.
Yeah, and when I'd read stuff of his, he'd bring that up as an example a good amount. And so like that was interesting too, because, you know, when you're young, or at least for me, I don't know about other people, but when I was a kid, when I was very little, be like, oh, the Oscars, they just tell you what the best is. And then when I started studying Spike Lee, he's just like, look at these omissions that they made. It's just like, oh, and then it kind of had me reconsidering certain institutions. And I think a lot of that started with, you know, studying people like Spike Lee, not just him, but him in particular.
I wanted to find out more of like kind of the ingredients of your show.
Well, for Magic Negro, I'd say the ingredients of that was a lot of the comedy that I think I first discovered when I was in high school, and then that kind of like influenced. I think, I don't know, I feel like other people too. It's just like whatever you first kind of watch, maybe like in junior high and high school, that really forms a lot of your sense of humor going forward, you know, because maybe that's like the age when you're first able to discover for yourself what you find funny. And so for me in high school, that was Chappelle's Show. Because Chappelle's Show was like on the air, like right in the middle of my high school experience. And so I remember like the next day or the next week in class, people talking about what happened the night before. And that's in that second season in particular, because I think the second season had like a little bit more like it was a little bit more in the spotlight than the first season was, I think. Mm-hmm. And so like from the beginning, it felt like most of that season, it was kind of like in the zeitgeist a little bit. And then also like that was around the time that DVDs just like exploded. Mm-hmm. So from that point forward, you know, people would always be playing him even years after, you know, that show ended. The Boondocks was also really big for me, not just the animated show, but also the comics. Mm-hmm. So I remember buying like the book that was like the book that had like the best of comics from like from the beginning of the comic book up until right before the show, called Right to Be Hostile. And I remember those comics just being so funny to me. And then Chris Rock, primarily like his first like two or three specials. So like Bring the Pain, Bigger and Blacker, those two in particular, I guess. And so I think at least comedically, and there's probably others too, but those are the three that I think like not only did I discover them then and they had a big impact on me then, but I revisit those a lot too.
Was Bigger and Blacker the one where he like did like the No Limit, the fake, like he, it was all like the Master P type letters on the front. Okay. I had that.
Right.
I definitely had that one.
Yeah. I think that was 99 if I'm not mistaken, something like that.
Okay. So we're just like a few years apart then. That would, okay. The bio mentioned that you took a film, you studied film in Northwestern, and I was just wondering like where the, like the label, the Magical Negro, when that became a thing in your mind, like when you became aware of that and started thinking about that.
Yeah, it may have kind of come up maybe like in high school, perhaps.
Okay, so before film class. Okay.
I think so. Cool. At least subconsciously.
Gotcha.
Because, I mean, because it's something that Spike Lee mentions, like that character, that archetype. And then when I went to college to study film, the thing that kind of was interesting about my first year there, I mean, all the years there, I guess, I was the only black guy in any of my film classes through all 4 years there. And what was interesting was it's like I'd be taking like these film classes, but then at the same time taking African-American studies classes, right? So what would be interesting is in these film classes, you would watch these classic movies, and pretty much in every, at least to me, especially like that freshman year, when we'd be watching all these like classics, pretty much in every movie, at least all the movies made by white people, like the depiction of black people was either jarring in terms of how they chose to depict them, or was jarring in terms of how they were like just not seen at all.
At all,
you know? Yeah. So, and that was interesting, especially because at the same time, you know, in these African American studies classes, you know, I'd read about like what black writers were writing at the time or what other black filmmakers were making at the same time that we were studying these other films, you know, all throughout the history of film, you know?
Right.
And so I can't remember if I actually, in my freshman year, if I did like a paper on the Magic Negro or if it was just on Song of the South, but I remember being like pretty fascinated that movie was made for just a number of reasons, because it came out in like 1941, 42. And I remember it was shot by Greg Toland, who also shot Citizen Kane. And I was a huge fan of Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, and also Greg Toland's work. And so seeing that he shot this movie, what that told me is that it's just like, and outside of the songs, outside of certain songs, the movie, I never really recall seeing it as a kid growing up, because Disney's worked really hard to bury it.
Yeah,
it didn't exist.
Yeah.
But it was just, but this was like a big budget Hollywood movie with like, you know, really great special effects and just like a very bizarre storyline, you know, and not just Greg Toland shooting it, but the woman that plays Charles Foster Kane's first wife, I forget the actress, but she's also the little boy's mom in Song of the South. So anyway, there were just these parallels between the films that I was studying at the time and this like this hidden movie that had all the same people working in front of him behind the camera, but it just was something that was never discussed. And I remember I had to get the book on like Laserdisc, I think, through through interlibrary loan. Because that was the only way you could see it, unless you were to go online to find some sort of a bootleg, or if someone just happened to have the VHS tape, it's not a movie you can find or get. And so I remember, doing this interlibrary loan and watching this, and just being fascinated by this movie. And so ever since, and then I think along with that paper, I can't remember if I did it then or later, but I went through other movies just trying to track this character and how it popped up in films. And, you know, surprising how often it happens, frankly, you know.
Yeah, so. Don't you think Green Book had it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and what I kind of like distill it down to, I think, is, you know, if you're talking about the magic Negro character, it's not always necessarily, the way I describe it in the show is like this old black man that's guiding the white male protagonist through the film. But another way to look at it to me is just like you have black characters that are in an environment where they're being oppressed, you know, but that's sort of ignored or glossed over in some way, softened. And meanwhile, they're just like very happy to share the screen with these other white characters that do get more character development, more attention with the plot, whatever it may be. So even though one character may not necessarily resemble the other one in terms of the way they look or sound, I feel what is similar is what they're trying to make the audience feel, you know, which is sort of like a lack of guilt for white audience members, you know. So that's the thing I think that pops up a lot, even if the look of the character might change. So they don't look like Uncle Remus necessarily, but the effect is still the same.
What's wild is when you started describing it, like the basics of it, that's pretty much it, chapter two. The character of, I think his name's Mike. I
mean, okay.
I don't know if you saw, it was 3 hours long, but man.
Oh, wow.
Mike just at one point, he's gone for so long that I thought he died and I missed it.
Oh, wow.
But he, in addition to that, he literally like has magic that they used. I'm pretty sure this, you know, so the only reason I mention any of this is to just sort of let people know that this is not something where we're talking about how movies used to be, like,
that's a great point.
this still very much exists, and something that they, once you're aware of it, you can't not notice it, or at least for me. How did you put the show together? Like, and what made you want to do it as a one man performance?
You know, I studied film in college, but I didn't really perform in college at all. And it wasn't until I left college, came back to Atlanta, and I've been doing improv for a number of years. And the theater where I do improv in Atlanta is a place called Dad's Garage Theater. Something that makes Dad's Garage kind of unique from most other improv theaters that I am aware of is that it's also simultaneously a theater company. So each year they produce a full season of plays. But the thing that again makes it different from a normal theater company is we do almost exclusively all new works written by the improvisers. So it's unique in that it's a theater company run by improvisers who write and perform in their own stuff. Mm-hmm. And so through that, I had the opportunity to pitch something. And I had already been kind of experimenting with solo sketch at the time, and this topic was something that had always sort of interested me. And so that's kind of how I started putting the show together, was that I had the opportunity through Dad's Garage, and I'd already kind of started putting some material together anyway. And so through being at Dad's Garage, that kind of gave me a deadline and some of the resources to to put it together.
I don't have a real sense of like how long, like how when you started Dad's Garage, and then how long it took to put the show together, and how long you've been doing it.
Well, I've been doing improv for about 10 years, I'd say. And I first did this show, Magic Negro, about 5 years ago. That's, I think, when I first started performing it. I think between the time that I pitched the show and it went up, it was probably like maybe 8 months, 6 to 8 months. But in terms of how long it takes to make a show is mostly dependent on the deadline, I would say. So if I had had 4 months, it would have been done in 4 months. And if I had 2 years, because I've since gone on to do several iterations of the show. So the show that I first did in 2014 doesn't bear a whole lot of resemblance to what it looks like now. There are certainly some things that are exactly the same, but I'd say that the show has gone through at least two or three key changes, some of which are reflected in the version that I'm doing in Athens this weekend.
Was it always just you doing the show?
Yes, it's always been a solo show, and it's always had a significant audience interaction. The thing that makes solo easier, I think, especially when you're talking about something like race, at least for me, it's easier sometimes doing the solo work as opposed to writing words and then passing them off to someone else. Because I guess I look at solo sketch more similar to how I would do stand-up, because I do some stand-up too. And it's, at least for me, it's just like there's less of a filter, and I'm kind of sharing these points of view with you that I could, I guess, put in a play and give to someone else. But to me, it's kind of like I wouldn't really write a stand-up set and then give it to somebody else to say. Not really. So at least with this solo show, that was kind of the idea behind it, is that, you know, these are kind of my thoughts. And I think that with race, I think everyone has such a unique experience, this unique to them. You could pass it off to somebody, but at least given the circumstances at the time, that didn't make sense.
I would imagine you go white people, some white people are coming to the show, if not sometimes, you know, majority of them. Did you ever feel like when you're sitting there talking to them as these characters, you're going like having sort of like a like an adjacent experience to the characters in those movies you're talking about, where like I'm teaching these people? I'm like, you know, is that part of the thought in there?
Sort of. I think that that's a little bit what gets explored in the show.
Okay.
The first year or so of me doing the show had whatever material was in the show. And after about a year of doing it, there were definitely those thoughts of, is the audience that I'm performing this for, like, really understanding it? Is this,
right.
Especially when I would go up for majority white audiences, which was most of the time coming from improv. Right. And there are definitely like a lot of second thoughts about, are they really understanding what I'm saying? Is it still productive if they don't understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And so there was a lot of that. And so in future iterations of the show, that became sort of weaved in a little bit more, at least towards the end, which is sort of questioning what's an appropriate way, you know, to explore race through comedy. When you have an audience that may not necessarily, when people may be in different places in their own like personal race journey or whatever you want to call
right.
it. But it's also intentional too, because I mean, it's just like, you know, you have this Magic Negro character that pops up at least a little bit throughout the show. Depending on the iteration, it's a lot or a little bit. And, you know, the way I kind of see it is in movies, the Magic Negro, they're usually there to help guide the audience and the characters on screen through like this narrative, to help them, make them feel like things are okay. You know, and that has a bunch of meanings, either like the main hero's in trouble and that character's there to make them feel like it's okay. Or it's just like someone going to see the movies and it's like, man, this black guy was smiling in the 1800s. I guess things weren't that bad then, you know?
Right.
And so with this sketch show, you have this Magic Negro that is instead kind of like saying, like, hey, you're going to see these things having to do with race, and I'm going to make you feel okay about it. And so hopefully what the audience does is, like, they see this character is making them laugh and making them feel better, but then maybe they ask, like, well, why is that? Why does this character make me feel comfortable?
Yeah.
Because he probably shouldn't, you know. He should probably make you feel uncomfortable, but I try to make him charming. And then maybe that charming quality gets gross by the end.
Yeah. I was on some panel that years ago we were talking about, like, film critics were talking, were bringing, everybody had to bring a movie that, like, everybody had seen that they hadn't seen. Uh-huh. And I actually, I think mine was either The Goonies or Karate Kid, one of those. And yeah. They're talking about, well, if you were to have like a, oh no, it was Goonies. They were like, well, if you were to, would you like to see a version of Goonies that had like a bit more of a diverse cast or like an updated thing? And I was like, no. I just want to know what the people of color that lived around that town were doing. Like, I'm interested in, I would rather see like, if we're going to remake these things, let's not remake them, just rewrite and go like Across Town or In the House Next Door or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I would much rather see that. It's funny that you mentioned that, because at Dad's Garage, I'm part of an all-black improv troupe, and we're called Dark Side of the Room. And what we do is we get a suggestion of a movie. So if someone were to say The Goonies, we'd be like, okay, we're now going to perform for you the deleted scenes of what the black characters were doing. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't mean to derail it. Which ones have you done?
We've done a lot. When I opened the show at Dad's Garage like 5 years ago, the show's usually like 60 to 70 minutes. So the first half would be me doing my solo show, and the second half would be Dark Side coming out, and we'd do a movie. So we've been together for probably like, I don't know how long, 5-6 years, something like that. I don't know the exact date, but we've done a ton. I mean, we've done everything. Last week we did Mean Girls. We've done Titanic. We've done Top Gun, Wizard of Oz. We did Toy Story one time. It's all over the place. We really get whatever. And the thing is, we really enjoy movies a lot.
Yeah, but, you'd have to know what to do, right?
I mean, yeah. But we do all kinds of things.
That is awesome. Okay, I need to recover from the mere thought of that for a second. Okay, God, that's great. Have you taken it out of state anywhere else around the country?
Yeah. I've been to a lot of places. I've been to Florida, Arizona, California, Texas, Rhode Island, New York a couple times. Been to Canada several times. Some random places that I can't remember. But I've been traveling with it for a while. So I've been to a lot of spots. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the general reaction, and is there like a different reaction from like in the South, let's say, versus somewhere else?
It's usually, yes. Overall, the reaction is pretty similar from place to place. Meaning, people tend to laugh in the same places or get uncomfortable in the same places. But I found that more so than region, it's like the racial makeup that determines where the laughs happen. So. For example, so it's really interesting to watch if there's like a decent mix of races in the audience, because a lot of times where white people will clam up, those are the times where black people will laugh and they'll have some sort of a release and vice versa. In fact, I was at the Alliance Theater a couple years ago in the spring of 2017. And, you know, usually their audience is upper class, older white people. And so sometimes I do like an early show and a late show. And a lot of times the early show would be the older white audience, and then the later show would be the younger, blacker audience. And it would be fascinating.
Really?
On some sketches. But yeah, there are some sketches. There's some sketches that I don't travel with because it's like more technically involved. But there's one version of a sketch where it takes a while to explain the context, but basically the punchline is the Migos comes on and I jump up and snatch a Confederate flag and skip around the stage. And there was one night in particular where I did that, and I got just zero reaction from the audience. Like, they didn't like the Migos. They didn't like me snatching the Confederate flag. They didn't like me skipping around, like doing a victory dance. But then the next show, the Migos came on, and this was when Bad and Bougie was like all over the place.
Right.
So this is when it was like very popular. That came on, people were loving it. The Confederate flag dropped, people reacted. And then when I snatched it, they went crazy, you know, and it was just like night and day. And so it was nice when both of those audiences are together. It's more pronounced when they're separate, you know. Sure. I'd say another thing that's kind of changed is I've gone to some places, and I think the one thing that has changed perhaps when I go to the South is so when Obama was elected, I think that the laughs came easier. And I'd say like since 2016, it's changed. Like I've gone to some places in the South, and pre-Obama, post-Obama, it's very different, you know, either with people like, I don't know, the energy has changed. And I'm not entirely sure why either. Because I mean, it could be simply who's in office, but it could also just be that in the years that have passed, like our national dialogues have kind of changed. So yeah. I don't know if the material just reads differently, but that is something that I've noticed because, like I said, there were some places that I went to like in 2015, let's say, and then I came back in 2017 and my experiences were very different.
Right. Sometimes it's just like, you know, as a white person, you're like, is it okay if I laugh at this? Or which parts am I not supposed to be like, you know what I mean? It's like, or what it means to you if you do laugh. I was, did you see the Superfly remake they did?
I didn't, no.
Okay, there's a scene in there where he's, Youngblood is chasing one of the bad guys through a cemetery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they do this awesome chase and they're just moving. They're going across the grass.
Yeah.
And he does this thing and it makes the bad guy's car crash and explode. But he crashes and explodes into a Confederate monument. Like, that's what he crashes into and explodes. And I just, you know, I bust out laughing. But then I look around and go, no? No? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was awesome.
Right.
So yeah. I guess you just really never know. You know what I forgot to ask you? Are you from Georgia?
I'm from Atlanta, yeah.
Okay, that's something that they'll want to know. Is there anything that you've gotten from the show? Like, what do you – I usually ask what do you hope people take away from it, but I also want to know, like, you know, what you've gotten out of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, like, changed me as a performer for sure. Just from, you know, because coming out of improv is so – collaborative. The thing that's, I've learned all kinds of things. I mean, I think it's taught, strangely, doing this solo show has taught me to be a better collaborator because of all the people I need to lean on to make it a thing, whether that's getting feedback on people, whether that's being directed by people or getting people to help me make the show. So in a weird way, like, I've collaborated more on the solo project than anything else. And then I think the other thing too that I've learned is that it's made me learn to start the process of being okay of not having to take care of a white audience all the time. And I think that's something that kind of gets explored at the end of this show and is also covered a little bit in my other show that I'm bringing up to Athens the same weekend, Diversity Now. And just not being as concerned about that.
I'm always curious about why, every time I talk to someone that does stand up, but particularly anybody that addresses issues like race, I always want to know, like, why do you feel like comedy is sometimes or so often the best way to address, like, things that are difficult and uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, I primarily do comedy, so I don't know. I guess it's kind of like comedy is what I do, and so I talk about what I care about. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know if it's better or worse than something else that's not comedy. But it's more so, it's just like, well, comedy is sort of like, you know, that's what I deal in. So that's kind of how it works for me. But I will also say, I think something that's perhaps unique to comedy that may be different from other modes of discussion is that, and this isn't always my priority or anything like that, but, you know, when it comes to something like race, for example, say I pose an argument and you're like, no, you shoot that down, but then I make you laugh with that same argument, that's almost kind of like a form of agreement, you know? Because I think, like, when you laugh, you're kind of laughing at something that you find true in that joke. And so if I'm making you laugh about whatever it may be, even if I get you for that 1 second, you know, I've kind of shown you that you actually do agree with me on some level. And so it's not like people be like, well, I laughed at that. All the Confederate monuments have to come down. You know, not that the people that think that all have Southern accents, but I'm just saying, like, so I'm not saying that would, like, change right away, but they're just like, oh man, this did make me laugh. Why did that make me laugh? And so I think maybe that starts the process of slowly over time. I don't know if it would ever change someone's mind, but I think it does, like, at least make them acknowledge the other perspective.
That is a great answer to that question. That's one of the better ones I've had. That's a great answer.
Oh, cool.
To that. Cool. Is there anything that you wanted to make sure that the people coming to the show know? Is there anything I did not ask you that you would want to make sure that we have in there?
I guess so. The first two nights I'm doing Magic Negro. The second two nights I'm doing Diversity Now. Both are comedies, but they're also two fairly different pieces. And Diversity Now is like a much newer piece. So it's, yeah, it's kind of like in the early phase of development, whereas Magic Negro I've been doing a while. But both are kind of interesting to watch for different reasons. So it's like Magic Negro is something that I've been kind of doing for a long time, whereas Diversity Now is like I'm still kind of figuring out what it is. So the experience, I think, for the audience is kind of different for each of those. But I guess the main thing that I say is they're both comedies, both meant to be enjoyed like comedies. I think that's kind of the main thing that I would say.
Okay, so like 10th and 11th, Thursday, Friday is going to be the Magic Negro, and then 12th and 13th, Saturday, Sunday, will be Diversity Now?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't want to, like, you don't have to give away a lot about what it is, but what can you tell me about Diversity Now?
Sure. Basically, you say a fictional company is wrapped up in a race scandal. And so then to save face, the one black employee, me, Mark Kendall, has to lead the new black employees through like a diversity inclusion seminar. Or a more easy way to put it is that it's a diversity. The audience is going to a diversity and inclusion seminar that goes completely off the rails.
That's great. Mark, I have loved talking to you.
Great. Awesome. I appreciate that.